You're on the air with AM 800 WRTH broadcasting. And thank you so much for tuning in. Tonight, I'm sharing a personal story. Something happened to me years ago, and even after all this time, I've never forgotten it. It's the story of a young man fresh out of high school and working his first real job. It's a story about performances, experiences, and my coworkers. One of whom was still working there at the time, and after all those years, he'd never asked for a dime. After all, it's difficult to put a ghost on the payroll. When I was a teenager, I was lucky enough to attend Davis High School, one of the major high schools in Yakima, Washington. Not only did I meet some lifelong friends, but the school has a working theater and auditorium. The theater is amazing, especially for a high school. It's got a good-sized fly gallery for raising and lowering curtains, and scenery, and all kinds of things for performances. It's great for hanging lights. You can move everything up and down, bringing it stage level and taking it up far above the stage so the audience can't see it. It's got a fantastic sound system. It's got a catwalk over the audience for lighting, and an orchestra pit that can be raised and lowered so you can have the orchestra in the pit, or you can raise it and just have that much more stage to work with. I got into stagecraft and theater technology because a friend of mine was into it. Also, the guy who taught the stagecraft classes was the same guy who taught audiovisual courses. Mr. Jim Sollers was a maker before the term maker ever existed. A former news cameraman, he knew more than his fair share about camera work, videography, and broadcasting. This was back in the days of VCRs, and he had a bank of several VCRs set up in the audiovisual room. Using a patch panel he'd put together by the grace of God and Mickey Mouse, he could put a tape in a VCR and send that video to any room in the school. So if Mr. Peterson's history class was watching a World War II documentary, all he needed to do was let Jim know and maybe get Jim the tape. The documentary would show up on the screen on time. It was absolutely a closed-circuit TV broadcasting studio. Jim even set up a channel on the closed-circuit TV system where the teachers could find out which channel to turn to for their videos. It was a whiteboard with the day's schedule written on it, and which channels were showing what videos and at what time. When I got into the class, I looked all around the room and didn't see the whiteboard. So I asked him about it, and with an absolute twinkle in his eye, Jim directed me towards a table where a small handheld whiteboard leaned against a wall, and there was a camcorder pointing at it. This whiteboard wasn't as big as a letter-sized sheet of paper. I learned something that day, and it was something that came to theater work. You can create something fantastic with the smallest things. The camcorder was something that was sitting around, useless, until Jim pointed it at a whiteboard, and suddenly, there's a program guide for the entire school. Since Jim taught the stagecraft classes, and since I really liked the man, I got into those as well. In 2 years, I learned how to light a stage, how to build scenery for a production, how to outfit a production with existing materials and items on hand, how to work the audio board, how to work the light board, how to run the fly gallery, how to work follow spotlights, and keep dancers lit up as they flew across the stage. And I learned how to manage a show. I didn't manage many of them because I liked working the other positions more. But you could say that stage management was my first foray into anything leadership-oriented. When I graduated in 1994, I had a job. I had a job almost literally waiting for me at the Premier Theater in Yakima, Washington, the Capitol Theater. I applied because Jim said I should. They were looking for experienced workers, and as things went, I had 2 years of experience. So I applied, and when the stage manager realized I was one of Jim's kids, there wasn't even much of an interview, other than just a few people showing me around and walking me through the paperwork. Depending on the position, I could make anywhere from $15 to $17 an hour. For a kid just out of high school in 1994, that's some pretty damn fine money. And I told you all of that for a couple of reasons. The first is to pay homage to Jim, because man absolutely changed my life. The second, and most highly pertinent to this story, the Capitol Theater is haunted. As Jim once said, of course it's haunted. All the best theaters are. The haunting was a bit of local folklore. The theater itself opened in April of 1920, just in time for the Roaring Twenties. Vaudeville was in its heyday, and the theater hosted some of the greatest shows of the times. It also featured traveling Broadway musicals, concerts, and provided a venue for speakers. The 1920s was a fantastic period in the history of American theatrical performance. But then, the 1930s brought with it the stock market crash, Black Thursday, the Dust Bowl, and eventually, the Great Depression. Theaters began to close because no one could afford to pay for live performances. The smart theater owner decided to pivot and take advantage of a new technology that also showed up in the 20s and quickly grew in popularity. Movies. For many theater owners, movies saved their businesses and their buildings. It was fairly easy to convert a theater into a cinema. All you needed was a screen hanging above the stage and then point a projector at it. You could show the same movie multiple times, and the actors never messed up a line. The performances were always well done, and the star of the show never got tired or sick. Even better, at least for the theater owners, you didn't need all of those stagehands to run a cinema. Rather than having a bunch of people working on lighting, pre-fly gallery, and so on, you needed someone to lower the screen, someone to dim the lights, and someone to flip a switch on the projector. Play your cards right and get these things set up the right way, and that could be done by the same guy. That put a lot of stagehands at work in a country that already had a raging unemployment problem. And you see, I want to put a pin in it, because we're going to come back to that in a bit. In 1973, the city of Yakima, working with the Allied Arts Council, obtained the Capitol Theater. They placed the building on the National Register of Historic Places, and the building became a real part of the city itself. And the ink wasn't all too dry on the paperwork when, in 1975, the theater suffered a massive fire. The entire audience section of the theater was gutted by the blaze, leaving only the walls standing around the destruction. Miraculously, the stage itself emerged relatively okay. The city began rebuilding the theater as soon as possible. They even hired the man who did the original murals and ceiling paintings to come out of retirement and repaint the dome above the audience. The theater reopened in 1978 with a sold-out performance by Bob Hope. But the fire left its mark, and while some things were repaired, others were left alone. For instance, there remained a door from the original stage setup. Originally, the door led to backstage corridors and access to the audience areas. This door is known to open and close on its own. It'll be open the next morning after somebody shut it the previous night. It will occasionally slam shut, startling anyone who can hear it. When I went to the Capitol, the area behind the door was used mostly for storage and things, stuff that wasn't always needed. Often, the last person to leave the room would literally block the door open a bit so it couldn't slam shut during a performance. And you might think it's all a prank. An early morning crew member opened the door. Someone was having a laugh by slamming it and running off to join the others in mock surprise. And you might be justified in that thought. Except, you see, the door was something like 10 feet above the stage floor. Over 3 meters, and there was no way to get to it unless you brought a ladder. Before the fire, the door had a staircase leading up to it. They didn't rebuild those stairs after the fire, and since you can only see the door from the stage, not the audience, I guess they just left it there. If you want to slam that door, the first thing you'll need is a ladder to get to it in the first place. Depending on the show, we'd have an early call time. And for those who aren't into the theater world, early call simply means you need to show up for work really early. For the big performances, this could mean on stage and awaiting instructions at 2 in the morning. After all, when you've got a traveling musical coming to town and they've got 3 or 4 semi-trucks pulling trailers loaded with equipment, it's gonna take some time to set up and get things ready for the performance that night. An early call typically leads into a late call, because after the show wraps, you need to tear all that stuff in and put it back in the trucks. I tell you this so you'll understand the reasons why only a few stagehands might be in a theater wandering around doing things on their own. People who'd worked there longer than I did knew about the slamming door of the stage floor. They'd tell you about the toilets flush downstairs when there's no one in the bathroom, no one else in the theater. And keep in mind, this is before the age of self-flushing toilets. Doors elsewhere in the theater would slam, and you'd hear whispering in the empty halls. One time, I was wandering around the catwalks above the audience, making some lighting. Ideally, you do this with two people, because you need one person on the catwalk to move the lights around, and another on the floor to tell you how to move the lights around. The catwalks aren't lit, because that would mess with the vision of someone trying to adjust the lighting on a semi-darkened stage. And for the entire time I was up there that day, I felt someone with me. I kept catching movement out of the corner of my eye, like a change in the ambient lighting, something moving in front of a light, or something throwing a shadow. I'd glance over and see nothing. But the hair on the back of my neck was standing straight up when I finally finished and returned to the floor. The guy down there, a senior technician who'd been talking me through the lighting changes, said that me and the other guy did a great job and the stage looked really good now for some kind of scene that we were setting up. What other guy? I asked. Whoever was up there with you, he replied. Dude, I said, I was the only one up there. He'd been there. He was used to this. Oh, he said, must have been Shorty. Shorty was the name given to the ghost of the Capitol Theater. I have no idea where the name originated, and since I never saw a full-bodied apparition while working there, I have no idea how tall this spirit was. Shorty wasn't malevolent, at all. With the slamming doors, the whispers, even up on the catwalk, I never felt afraid. I was on edge, like I knew someone was around me, and I kind of felt almost awkward about not acknowledging them. Shorty was, and I assume still is, a trickster. He's having some fun, and I'm sure that little stagehand gets a kick out of it when someone jumps or gets the willies. And notice what I said there. Stagehand. See, there's a local legend, though I've never confirmed it, that says back in the 1930s, the theater was laying off so many of its employees. There was one who wound up remaining a little bit longer. The story goes that he was let go that day. His last duty was to head up into the fly gallery and lower the screen for the movie that evening. If that's true, it's a bitter irony that the last thing he needed to do before leaving work was to go set up the very thing that was putting him out of work. According to the stories, he lowered the screen from the first rail of the fly gallery. That's where most of the fly gallery techs worked, and was where all of the ropes and tie-offs were for raising and lowering whatever hung on the battens. High above that first rail was the second rail. Soaring 64 feet, or nearly 20 meters above the stage, was the counterweight rail, where large weights would be loaded onto the counterweight arbors. By adding counterweight, you'd be able to pull up heavy curtains, lights, and scenery hanging above the stage. The Capitol's fly gallery has what's called a double throw system, which means that for every pound of weight you add to the batten, you add 2 pounds of arbor. So if they load 500 pounds of lights to the batten, you just need 1,000 pounds of counterweight. This is added to the fly while the batten is on the stage being loaded. While it's down, the counterweight arbor is the second rail, sometimes called the loading rail. The lore is that this stagehand lowered the screen, then climbed the ladder to the second rail, and jumped off into the empty air. As far as I know, it's just a story. But like all good stories, it fits. Many people, facing unemployment during the Depression and a highly uncertain future, took their own lives. But honestly, I'm not sure I believe it. If for no other reason that Shorty's personality It just didn't seem right for it. But before we wrap up here and start loading those trucks, I've got one more story for you. And it's one of the best ghost stories I could ever tell. Not because it happened to me, but because it was a supernatural event witnessed by over 1,000 people. The Capitol Theater has a tradition that, during the holiday season, they secure performance of the Nutcracker Suite. I can easily trace my love of ballet to the theater calling me in to work follow spot for that show. It was a gorgeous production, and the dancing was amazing. For this particular performance, we had a traveling crew and ensemble. With the traveling crew comes their own stage manager. It's not all that unusual at all. After all, if you go to see the traveling performance of, say, Avenue Q, you can bet that the show is being managed by someone who travels with the production. The stage manager knows the show better than most anyone else ever could, and certainly better than the local stage manager. So what typically happens is the local stage manager and the road manager work together to get things set up and running smoothly, and each will be relaying directions specific to their expertise. So while the travel manager may know how to call lighting changes for the given scenes, the local manager will know how that needs to happen and relay instructions specific to the theater's equipment. Now then, there's a scene in The Nutcracker where snow falls from the sky. On stage, this is handled through the use of a brilliantly simple thing called a snow baffle. Here's the basics of how it works, and you can actually make your own. Go get yourself a big old sheet, biggest you can find, and cut slits through it at regular intervals. Just slits, not holes. Don't make them too wide, because what you're going to do is fold the sheet in half lengthwise, and then hold the corners of it between you and a partner. Pull the top tight between you, while pulling the bottom down snugly. Fill the sheet with some kind of fake snow. Feathery material works best, and indeed, down would be a good choice. What you're looking for are bits of snowflake that won't just fall between the slits while the sheet is standing still. Now, once you've got some snow on the sheet, rest for a bit. Some stuff will naturally fall out on its own, especially if you were hoisting this above a stage. But after a few minutes, things will calm down, and the snow remains pretty stable and steady. Now, to make it snow, let the bottom go slack, and then you and your partner alternate between moving the sides of the sheet up and down. This opens up the slits just a bit and lets the snow fall through. The snow baffle works almost exactly that way, except it's positioned using battens in the gallery. During the setup, we got the snow baffle filled early and hoisted it above the stage to let it settle. By the time the audience began arriving for the show, the snow in the baffle had settled and everything was fine. When places were called, I was up in the follow spot booth in the far back of the house. We had wired headsets to the stage so instructions and changes could be called up. I'd set up my light, adjusted the volume on my headphones, and got ready. The curtain went up, the dancers began, and the performance was amazing. It was going to be magical. It was really an exquisite ballet. Everything was going smoothly until it started snowing during an inside scene. At first, it was just a flutter. Maybe the snow hadn't quite settled enough, but then the flutter turned into more. It never got to the point of a blizzard, but there was assuredly snow falling when the characters were supposed to be inside. The traveling stage manager was on the headsets immediately, and he was not happy. He was calling up to the Fly Gallery, demanding to know what the hell was going on. The Fly Gallery techs responded, telling the traveling manager to look up on the rail, and as they said this, they shined a flashlight over to the ropes controlling the snow baffle. The ropes were going up and down. Not a lot, but apparently enough that you could see it from across the stage where the road manager was standing. Those ropes were moving up and down, and there was absolutely no one near them. What's more, there was no one on the second rail either. To the road manager's credit, he was a veteran of many theaters, which you'd expect for a traveling showman. He sighed, and with a tone of resignation said, "Oh, you've got one of those here too, huh?" The snowing stopped soon after. To the audience, those who noticed it, it was maybe played as a blooper, a missed cue, a gaffe. For those of us behind the stage, well, we knew better. And some of us were giggling right along with Shorty. Thanks for listening, and good night.